Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 27, 2017. Refugees in northern Uganda tell horror stories of being tracked down by armed men in the bush after fleeing their villages in Yei County.
All the time, fear, even the only time is the night hours. During the day hours, when sun has arise, from 9 up to 5, this time we will not get any people. They are hiding in the bush.
And a woman in Juba says she was beaten by presidential bodyguards at the residence of South Sudan's first vice president.
He ordered me to get out of the car. When I got out of the car, he cocked the gun immediately. So when he cocked the gun, I was scared. So I was like, okay, why are you cocking the gun? You stopped me and you warned me and I told you, I'm sorry for passing here. Or maybe I was ordered to sit down and then immediately I had people beating me.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese refugees arriving at the MVP camp in Uganda's Arua district from Yei County say armed men continue to force civilians to abandon their villages and flee across the border. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Arua district in Uganda's West Nile region.
The refugees normally arrive at the main reception center at the MVP camp, exhausted and hungry. Some of the refugees are barefoot and travel with only the clothes on their back. Emmanuel Mauer, who along with other refugees walked to the border, says he had no intention of leaving his village until life became unbearable for him and his family, as armed men tracked them down to their hideout in the mountains.
Yeah, we'll stay outside on the bush there, maybe almost 2 months. So they saw there's no people there. That's why also they started to look where are the people staying. They reach up to, there's other mountains there, people run there. So they reach there to kill people.
Cosmos Lokonga, also from Yei, says he and a large number of people from his village were also forced to abandon the relative safety of their sanctuary in the bushes around Yei. He says more problems follow them on their journey toward the Ugandan border.
The road is not okay. The time when we came, there's a certain place called Tale in Mugopayam. We was been staying there for about 3 weeks. Then the government soldiers came there to the market. They start to shoot people. They shoot 4 people.
Mao says getting out of Yei was just as dangerous as remaining in the town or the surrounding villages and bushes.
We are using foot, even we have spent 7 days on the way to reach here. If they get anybody, on the way, they're going to kill you.
Lokonga says threats along the journey to Uganda forced him and others not to travel with the elderly of their community, as most would have simply died on the way or endangered the lives of others trying to help them.
All the people are there. Who is easy either sometimes reach to 94, they are still behind. The reason why we leave these people, sometimes to manage that we want to bring them, we can die. That is why we leave them.
Meta Isaac, another refugee from Yei, says daily life continues to be a nightmare for citizens who live in constant fear of armed men roaming the towns and villages around Yei.
All the time, fear, even the only time is the night hours. During the day hours, when sun has arise, from 9 up to 5, this time we will not get any people. They are hiding in the bush.
Yei has some of the most fertile lands in South Sudan and most of its people are farmers. Isaac says because crop yields are high, some locals have decided to stay. But he predicts they too might be forced to give up farming and flee as security conditions worsen.
Our land is supposed to be okay, good for planting, we cultivate supposed, but this time even has given less hope to all the people, and some of them, they're staying there. They say they want at least to cultivate, but every time gunshot.
Like most South Sudanese escaping the conflict in their country, Lokonga says he left his village with nothing valuable.
We leave everything. Even I have some 27 cows and 11 goats. This was taken by the government soldiers.
The South Sudan Army has consistently said it has no policy of targeting civilians. It says refugees often make up stories against the army in order to strengthen their case for asylum. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
A picture of a South Sudanese woman who says she was beaten by bodyguards of South Sudan's first vice president is all over the social media. Aring Madut says she was beaten during the early hours of Saturday morning after she gave a lift to her friend. She says the incident happened in front of the official residence of Taban Dengai in Tomping suburb.
I happened to pass through that road, and it is not my first time to pass through that road because I felt it is more secure than passing the next route, because I trusted these people that for my own protection I can be safe passing there. And then as I move, because there are potholes ahead of me, because there are a little bit of potholes, because when it rains, it's really scary. So I think as I was driving slowly, I think the guard thought maybe I was up to something. So he stopped me. Then I stopped. And I was talking to him. In fact, I was even speaking to him in English. And then he was like, how come that I came when the lights are on? And I was trying my best to tell him, you know what, I'm sorry that I came the lights are on. And then he told me, it is wrong and it is a warning for you to pass here. And I'm like, okay, what do you want me to do? You want me to go back or you want me to, you have to leave me and go to my place, because this is the area I live. Due to the conversation we've been having, I think maybe he never liked it. And he ordered me to get out of the car. I got out of the car. When I got out of the car, he cocked the gun immediately. So when he cocked the gun, I was scared. So I was like, okay, why are you cocking the gun? You stopped me and you warned me. And I told you, I'm sorry for passing here, or maybe I'm sorry for maybe the lights on. You know, I was ordered to sit down, and then immediately I had people beating me. So from there, I did not resist. I sat down, I was beaten up. As I'm talking to you, I still have the clothes that I was beaten up on the clothes I wore that day. So when the rest of the girls came in, they asked what happened. And then I explained to them. And then from there, immediately they figured out that I was drunk. You have to get into your car. You don't need to move at this time. You don't need to move at night. So they ordered me to get in the car. Then I got in the car.
But when they were beating you, did you identify yourself as someone who is working in the system? Did you tell them that you work in the system?
They didn't give me a chance even to talk. If they would have given me a chance, this thing would have not happened. They didn't give me a chance. I think they saw me as just a woman. Because like sometimes when I'm seen, people think I'm not a South Sudanese. People think I'm a wewe. The following day, as I'm telling you, when I came with my mother, the same thing happened. When my mom was trying to inquire and find out what it is, these boys, they didn't give her a chance. They insulted my mom, called my mom names. So when I saw my mom is being surrounded, I got out. When I got out, I recognized one of the guys that was part of the beating yesterday. So I told mama, this is one of the guys that was part of the beating. And he said, yeah, you came drunk and you wanted to grab the gun. I'm like, how would I grab a gun in a car? If I want to harm the first vice president or anybody around here, I will come with my own gun. The next day, I went through another beating. My mom is my witness. The people who are standing are my witnesses. I was beaten by one of the guys, the guy that was in a uniform. He beat me up and he tried to force me to get into the car. Then I told them, I am not getting into this car. If it is by force, I am not getting into the car. And you guys have to explain to me, why are you beating me up? I don't see any reason. I'm harmless. There's nothing. I didn't even carry any gun. When they saw that there was no any other way, one of the guys came. And then he asked me politely. Then I said, yes, now you're talking. I got into the car. But I was really angry. And I am so angry right now, to be honest, because I want the right thing to be done. That's all I want. Because this has been happening. It has been happening to innocent people. What if I wasn't the daughter of somebody that was known in South Sudan? Like, honestly, I wasn't a daughter of someone that lost his life for this nation. Would anybody be in a position to ask to Right.
Sorry about that. I see that you're getting emotional a little bit. We have been hearing stories about people being beaten by men in uniform. But have you reported this to the highest authorities in the country?
This beating has been happening. I've been hearing about it until I had to be beaten. Now I believe people are being beaten. I love this nation with the beats of my life. I love this nation with the whole of my heart. All I want is the right thing to be done. All I want is for the citizen of South Sudan to freely move. All I want is whenever you find a man in a uniform, you don't run away from a man in a uniform. You always have to go to the man in a uniform in order to help you out, not in order to harm you.
Are you trying to open a court case against the people who beat you?
The thing is, I am part of the system. I'm part of the same people that beat me. I'm part of the unit. But all I want is the right thing to be done.
That was Aring Madut, a South Sudanese, who says she was beaten by bodyguards of South Sudan's first Vice President Aban Dengai. She spoke to me from Juba earlier today. The spokesman for the office of South Sudan's first Vice President disputes Aring's version of the story and says the bodyguards of the first Vice President did not beat Aring. Chol Lam says witnesses told him that Aring was in what he calls an intoxicated state of mind when she drove near the house of the first Vice President. Lam promised to investigate the incident.
Before I even comment on the story itself, I would just like to say that such stories are stories that require attention, but there are several ways of doing that. And I appreciate you as a Voice of America taking the time to actually call to inquire. The incident that has been reported on the credible media that is Radio Tamazight and Sudan Tribune, it appears to be a tabloid. What has been reported is an incident that took place on the 24th of June, which is Friday night, early morning of Saturday, which is the 24th, involving a certain young lady getting into a verbal altercation with the guards of the first vice president. After we did our own investigation from within, it is identified that at 3:15 a.m. On Saturday morning, a certain young lady came driving, and she was in what appeared to be a severe intoxication. She came driving past the house of the first vice president. Being ungodly hours of 3 a.m., she was questioned, and guards were trying to check her status of cohesiveness. She seemed to be very intoxicated, so she was questioned and found that she was not a threat, and she was asked to proceed to where she was going. Apparently, what has happened is that she felt that she was not supposed to be questioned based on her own perception. And this is from outside of the story again, I would like to confirm. And she got into a verbal altercation with the guards and actually even caused self-inflicted wounds by falling off the car of her own vehicle after being so intoxicated.
When I spoke to her, she sounded a little bit traumatized, and she said the beating did not only happen Saturday morning, but when she went back with her mom, she said that she was also beaten in the presence of her mom. This looks like a situation that has been reported over and over, that there are men in uniform in South Sudan who are trigger happy.
I refute the statement completely based on my version of investigation and being narrated by people who were in the right state of mind, who were actually carrying their duty. The version of the story I'm told, and after investigation, is that she came back at 6 a.m. again. She did not wait for the right moment to come and raise her concern to the rightful people. She came back at 6 in a state of mind of being angry and frustrated. And her being accompanied by her mother, I don't think anybody would ever touch anybody else while the presence of elderly people that we respect. And therefore, I would like to actually question it. I'm not just going to leave it at that. As I've said before, I would look for the young lady, which we've been trying to get a hold of her today, to speak to her and get her version of the story. Again, Mr. Tanza, we will not tolerate any behavior, any abuse. especially for men of uniform. These are men that are entrusted to carry protection of civilians, and they're supposed to serve and protect and not abuse based on their willing or based on their own desire.
But looking at her pictures on the social media, she has a swollen face. I mean, it's a sign of a beating, Chol. I understand. I agree with you that you're doing your own investigation and you're getting the side of the story from the guards who were there and witnesses.
What I was told is that she came intoxicated. She came very intoxicated, already with grievances, and she jumped out of the car herself. She was angry. She seemed very angry, and this is what raised the suspicions of the guard that was on duty, that why would somebody come at 3 o'clock in the morning in that condition, in that state of mind? And when she was questioned, she decided to escalate the matter by jumping away from the car. When more witnesses came, she begged that she should be let go, and she was just going to go straight home, and which she returned back again. I would like to invite her to the office again tomorrow, and we want to hear her side of the story. And if it is an action that needs correction and punishment, then we will take that because we should not condone such behavior to allow any of our citizens to be abused under any circumstances.
That's Chol Lam, spokesman of the South Sudan's first vice president, Aban Dengai. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at how the refugees are faring in Uganda. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite thing about your country?
We have good culture. We are most welcoming people.
The people are very social. There is no discrimination between them.
The fact that they gave us women emancipation, we can voice out our ideas, our opinions. We can also make decisions in the homes. We can also get education, you know. We can also get educated like any other person.
My favorite thing about my country, it's freshwater bodies. Was me, one of my greatest hobbies, are swimming.
Regardless of tough times, dignity, values, and self-respect remain the first priority of my people. So therefore, I'm very proud of that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about the spread of hepatitis B in parts of Uganda and West Nile region. Authorities link the problem in part to the influx of South Sudanese refugees. Area officials say refugees entering Uganda in need of treatment consume a large part of Uganda's health budget. Catherine Nambi has the story for VOA from Kampala.
A majority of South Sudanese fleeing violence in their country head towards Uganda's West Nile region, which is reporting an increase in hepatitis B infections. According to health officials, many arriving South Sudanese are infected, while others have not yet been immunized. Apenyo Kennedy is a medical clinical officer at Paglinya Health Center 2 in Paglinya Refugee Settlement in the West Nile region, near the border with South Sudan. He says the number of people that test positive to the disease during screening is increasing.
When we test, like, let's say if it's 50, out of the 50 we can get 3 or 4 positive. I would say the rate of positivity is high. Before the influx of South Sudanese, it was a bit low, but when the South Sudanese came in, the rate actually became high. And as I talk now, the rate is actually higher.
To control the disease, diagnosis and vaccination have been heightened in the settlements, but according to Taco Steven, a medical clinical officer at Maji 3 Health Center in Maji Refugee Settlement, the number of those who show up for the services is overwhelming.
Every Tuesday, we carry out general vaccination of people who turn negative against hepatitis B. On average, it's 70 particularly this week, we have vaccinated 74. So it ranges from 60 to 80. And then for those who turned positive, we register them and then we give them an appointment of 6 months. So after 6 months, they come for retest. So again, if they turn positive, that is when we refer them for liver function test as the protocol requires.
Titus Jogo is a refugee desk officer in the Adjumani district of West Nile region. He says the influx of refugees has worsened the already high burden of hepatitis B in West Nile and Northern Uganda regions.
We have cases of hepatitis B, which is bigger in the refugee population as compared to Adjumani. Adjumani is the West Nile region, and the West Nile region and the great Northern Uganda, you know, hepatitis B is a problem. But again, it has been made worse by the number of refugees who have come infected by that problem.
Northern Uganda records the second highest hepatitis B rates at 21.7%, while the West Nile region comes third with 18.5% of the total Ugandan hepatitis B prevalence. It is transmitted through contact with someone carrying the virus, including during sex or from mother to child during birth. It can also be transmitted by contaminated needles during injection. Symptoms include vomiting, yellowish skin, fatigue, and abdominal pain. Jogo says the Ugandan government is shouldering a huge burden of vaccinating and treating the refugees.
We receive most of these children and pregnant women who have not yet been vaccinated and immunized. And as you were aware, these vaccines, the government plan is for a particular population at a particular time. But with the continuous influx, we've gone to incur more expenses on the procurement of additional vaccines for vaccination and the immunization.
It is estimated that at least 3.5 million people are living with hepatitis B in Uganda, accounting for 10% of the population. In 2010, the decision-making body of the World Health Organization recognized viral hepatitis as a global public health problem and the need for governments to take action to prevent, diagnose, and treat the illness. WHO works with governments and NGOs to develop and implement strategies to prevent the spread of the disease. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA Africa News in Kampala.
A South Sudan expert and research professor at Tufts University in the United States says famine has become less rare and less lethal over the last half century. But he says there have been some expectations, including Somalia and South Sudan. Alex DeWals tells Ayen Bior that while famine are largely preventable, a catalogue of past famines show that they are almost always used for political leverage.
The great lesson of the last 100 years of famines around the world is that they are almost entirely political. Famines are caused by political decision. That political decision may be against the background of deep poverty and natural disaster, but famines are entirely preventable. And when we see a famine, we know someone has either blundered politically or committed a political crime.
Now, the World Peace Foundation looked at famines since 1870 that killed at least 100,000 people. What did you learn from that catalog? Did you see any patterns or any reoccurring practices?
We see a number of very important things. The most significant is that although famines today are largely associated with Africa, in fact, over the 150 years, about 10% of the people who died in famine have been Africans, but more than 60% have been Asians. Other large famines occurred in Europe, particularly in the Soviet Union, due to Stalin's policies and due to World War II. There's been a really very, very dramatic drop in the numbers of famines, and even more so in the numbers of people who die in famines in the last 30 to 40 years. That's associated with growing prosperity around the world, declining armed conflicts, and greater effectiveness of public health and humanitarian efforts. There are, of course, some terrible exceptions to this this positive trend, including Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen at the moment.
What is unique about South Sudan's famine, or is there anything unique about it, especially looking at the other three famines or potential famines in the world right now?
South Sudan's had a very sad history of famines over the last 30 or so years. All the famines in South Sudan during the 80s and 90s were caused by the particularly vicious counterinsurgency inflicted by successive governments in Khartoum, the use of siege tactics, the destruction of crops and livelihoods, forcing people from their homes, and in particular, Khartoum's use of the militia strategy. And the hope and the expectation was that when peace came to South Sudan in 2005, that this would be the end of famine. And indeed, it wasn't the end of hunger as such. There was still chronic hunger in South Sudan because of the legacy of war and all the destruction and impoverishment. But for almost 10 years after the signing of the CPA in January of 2005, we didn't see those virulent large-scale outbreaks of mass starvation, which are famine. And tragically, now we see them again.
In your piece, you point to a protocol in the Geneva Convention that states that starvation of civilians as a method of warfare is prohibited. And you mention that this application is bold, but it's also limited. What did you mean by that?
It has two major limitations. One is that the two additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions of 1977, one for international armed conflicts, and this is the one which you've just been quoting. And so it doesn't apply to civil wars. And the second is that even in where it does apply, the principle of military necessity overrules it. So you are, under these laws of war, allowed to starve civilians if it is the only way of achieving a military objective, such as capturing a besieged garrison town. So I argue that we need to be stronger in our condemnation of famine and our condemnation of mass starvation. And we need to specify that it is a crime in and of itself. And I would like to see international courts and indeed national courts bringing individuals, military commanders and others, to court and trying them for the forcible starvation of civilians.
Is there anything else that the international community can look at to end mass starvation?
Mass starvation is a form of mass atrocity, and mass atrocities tend to occur in war with governments or political leaders who are not accountable. So it's absolutely essential in South Sudan, especially, that there is peace, there is accountability, an end to atrocities. And if those things happen, then immediately there will be humanitarian relief and people will be brought back from the brink. And in the medium and longer term, South Sudan, which is, after all, one of the most fertile and productive food-producing areas on this planet, will then be able to prosper, and its people need never go hungry again.
That was Alex Dewal, Tufts University professor and founder of the World Peace Foundation, speaking to Ian Buell from Medford, Massachusetts. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Dudu by Sultan Clinton. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here, and we hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama dudu si fuana, yomi alingi nuko. Asala na gali mama wimu ye, ana fikili mulo moshu ye. Dudu ye, ah, dudu ye, malita si fuani na si.